Welcome to the Science Translational Medicine podcast. This is Katrina Kellner. I'm the editor of AAAS's new journal, Science Translational Medicine, and I'm very pleased today to be here with our new senior scientific advisor, Elazar Edelman. Dr. Edelman joins our distinguished advisory board and our chief scientific advisor, Elias Serhuni, in providing expert counsel to our staff and to our authors. Dr. Edelman himself exemplifies the interdisciplinary nature of translational medicine, as he is both a cardiologist and an engineer. He's the Thomas D. and Virginia W. Cabot Professor of Health Sciences and Technology at MIT and Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. He directs the Harvard-MIT Biomedical Engineering Center. Welcome, Dr. Edelman.
Thank you.
Elazar, your unusual multidisciplinary training and experience undoubtedly give you a unique view on engineering, science, and medicine, and how we can best use the advances in science and engineering to further clinical excellence. I'd be very interested to know what you think is needed to accelerate progress in translational medicine.
That's an interesting question. I think that there are a variety of things that need to be present in order for translational medicine to succeed. In the first case, you need people committed to the notion of translational medicine. Just a word on this now, we can come back to it later, but translational medicine or translational research is not applied research in the same way that it's not basic research. It is an special commitment to embracing an obligation to society in the midst of doing the research. It is that the scientist thinks constantly that while doing the research, there must be at some point along the way an application of communal benefit. It doesn't mean that the work is applied. It means that the scientist must be committed to doing the work for the sake of investigation, for the sake of answering critical questions, for the sake of discovery that will improve the quality of people's lives. And there may be a long time between the concept and the clinic, between the bench and the bedside, but the translational scientist must always see the goal as an obligation, a responsibility, a societal responsibility. So the first thing that has to be present is the committed investigator. And then there needs to be a variety of other things in place to allow that committed investigator to achieve that. There needs to be dedicated resources to support the scientist. These have to be physical elements, bricks, mortar, equipment. It has to be the personal support, mentors, career paths, whether it's in academia or industry. There needs to be institutional support and institutional commitment that values this and rewards it and supports it. There needs to be funds. And in an era such as the one that we're in right now, that is of the great rate-limiting factors that we face. And now there needs to be venues from which to be able to explain and describe and promote those, and that's what Science Translational Medicine is filling the niche of a journal for translational medicine. As a third element, we need to be able to train people in this. We need to be able to articulate a message. We need to train young investigators so that they do not have to absorb this ad hoc, but can make the best use of the resources and in a much earlier stage than many of us, possess the tools, gain the tools to become translational scientists. And finally, translational science is a bit different than other scientific investigation, is that it's by its very nature interdisciplinary and collaborative. And we have to be a little bit more flexible about what we in academia in particular see as valid collaborations. And in this regard, have perhaps a firmer handshake with industry.
Because you've had years of experience in several different fields and yourself are an interdisciplinary scientist, and you've specifically been applying advances in the physical sciences to clinical issues, you've probably encountered every issue that's out there. So what special challenges are there in trying to do this, that is, apply physical science concepts to clinical issues. How does this kind of translation of engineering advances into clinical progress differ from, for example, the development of pharmaceutical agents for treatment of disease?
So the way I think about this is drugs and devices. And not just devices, but devices that have to operate inside a body. So for drugs, you actually have multiple chances to get it right. For drugs, you have multiple quantifiable steps that you can use as metrics of success all along the way. A drug should have a defined mechanism of action, a defined mechanism of action that can be assayed on a molecular, cellular, maybe even tissue level. And it's only then when it's deemed both safe within model systems and has a high likelihood of efficacy that one feels comfortable proceeding into testing in humans and use in humans. With devices, you don't always have the luxury of those multiple gates and multiple metrics. A device, regardless of whether it functions or not outside the body, has a completely different set of issues inside the body. That it whirls and spins or flashes outside the body makes no difference if it doesn't meet its fundamental requirement inside. And for most devices, there is no molecular, cellular metric that one can use. And so we're restricted when we deal with devices because we really only have one shot at getting it right. We still have all the elements of safety, but we don't have any of the assurance or mitigation of risk for efficacy.
I'd be very interested to know, and I'm sure our listeners would be too, what you think the greatest recent successes have been in deploying engineering solutions to medical problems.
The National Academy of Engineering listed recently the top 20 engineering achievements, and one can look at those. For me, though, recent really is about 100 years old, and that is, go back to the turn of the 20th century, and we see this tremendous burgeoning of the introduction of the physical sciences into biology and medicine. Begins, interestingly enough, in the same year, in 1895, when Eindhoven and Röntgen invented EKGs and discovered X-rays. And everything, in a sense, or many things, in a sense, have come about as a result of that. So the most recent elements, things like profound advances in imaging, from whole body imaging to molecular imaging, are in some extent the natural logical extension of Röntgen's discovery of X-rays. But they are now the area of greatest recent achievement and greatest hope for the future, that we will one day soon be able to diagnose non-invasively and even treat on the basis of those diagnoses through the use of sophisticated imaging. For specific devices, for the marriages of technology and intervention, this has been a remarkable period of time. In my own field, angioplasty, stents, drug-eluting stents, and all of the molecular agents that are now used to treat the spectrum of cardiovascular diseases started first with an understanding of mechanism of disease, and then embraced technology and leveraged technology to bring the mechanism into the therapeutics. I think one could go on and on, everything from dialysis to contact lenses, but at the end of the day, those, interestingly enough, embrace yet a third issue, all the advances in material science. I think as we go forward, imaging, technology, marriage with drugs, and then advances in material science will continue to allow things like cell-based therapies, regenerative medicine, minimally invasive technologies to forever change the way we perceive medicine and interventional science.
I know there's been recent work on spinal injuries or back pain, and there was a recent paper in a neurology journal about epilepsy showing that actually some of the things you see on MRIs that one might have assumed and perhaps many clinicians did assume were diagnostic, in fact, don't have much to do with symptoms of disease and can't be used as a real diagnosis of, say, a back problem that needs surgery. So isn't that a problem with imaging? Is it really that much of an advance?
I believe it is, but I believe it's the double-edged sword of all translational research, or, in a sense, all technology. Advances in technology always are in front of an understanding of how to use the technology. One can make the argument that what you articulated so nicely for imaging applies to everything that we do. There is usually skepticism, followed by an unbridled enthusiasm, followed by disappointment, and then settling out of a steady state. That's the natural evolution of how technology enters into a marketplace. So yes, we really do not yet possess all the tools to take advantage of the successes of imaging. But what it means is we therefore have an obligation to understand this far better, to understand it in far greater detail, and to make it such that we can use that technology more profoundly and more beneficially.
Finally, I wanted to ask you a little bit about process. Devices are regulated, as are drugs, by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the European EMA. What do you think those agencies could be doing differently to more effectively regulate devices?
I work with the FDA, and they are in an unfortunate bind. If they let technology into the marketplace early so that it has the optimal chance of helping people, they're accused of not doing their due diligence. And therefore, what can sometimes happen is that we can benefit millions and put tens or even hundreds or maybe thousands of people at risk. If, however, we totally erase all of the risk so that the benefit that could still be seen by millions comes at no risk for an individual, then we could delay almost indefinitely the introduction of critical technologies and critical therapies into the community, into the clinic. So they have this tension between what one set of physicians has as their creed, which is above all, do no harm, and what another set of clinicians have as their creed, which is rush to treat. And that places them in this constant battle with knowing what to do. And so what I have embraced is the understanding of neither rush to treat nor above all, do no harm, but above all, seek to understand. Because if you can inform people of how devices and drugs should work, if you can inform the public and you can inform the clinicians and you can inform scientists of how a drug action will have a positive effect and potential negative effect and how a device could potentially do wonderful things but has a defined risk, then you can embrace the risk at the same time of embracing the benefit. The problem is that requires a shift in thinking, not only on the part of FDA to insist that people divulge all that they know and not penalize them for supplying information, but that the people who develop technologies will now have to trust the FDA and the EMA and other regulatory bodies to not use information against them, but rather to credit them for supplying as much mechanistic insight as possible.
No doubt that will require a shift in culture to some extent.
Absolutely.
This has been the Science Translational Medicine Podcast with Katrina Kellner and Senior Scientific Advisor Elazar Edelman. This show is a production of Science Translational Medicine and AAAS working together to advance science and serve society. On behalf of Science Translational Medicine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for listening.